Good morning, Your Honor. David Baldwin, Potter, Anderson, and Caroon for the Health Appellees. My colleague William Passanante from the Anderson Kill Firm is going to argue for us today. He's joined by his partner Alex Hardiman and my colleague Jennifer Wasson.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. J.R. Julian on behalf of Fireman's Fund. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Barry T. Basis of the New York firm of Trestler, LLP, who will present the argument on behalf of Fireman's, and he has been admitted pro hoc. Mr. Basis.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, Robert Katzenstein for defendants below RSUI Indemnity Co. and Axis Reinsurance Company. Appearing with me today for RSUI are Joan Gilbride and Robert Benjamin of the firm of Kaufman, Borgeast & Ryan in New York. And appearing for Axis is William Smith of the firm of Wiley Ryan in Washington, D.C.
Welcome all.
Morning, Your Honors. Seth Niederman from Fox Rothschild on behalf of Old Republic Insurance Company. I'm joined by my colleague at counsel table, Michael Goodstein from the Bailey Cavallari firm. Thank you.
Welcome.
Morning, Your Honors. John Ballinger, Waite & Williams, on behalf of National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh. I rise to introduce my partner, Lawrence Bistany, who will make the argument on behalf of National Union.
Welcome.
May it please the Court. My name is Lawrence Bistany. I'm here representing National Union, which is the lead appellant on Appeal 565. The plaintiffs in the underlying action, Endion and Health, filed a declaratory judgment action seeking coverage for three different towers of insurance which were issued to Endion or its predecessors, Synetic and Medical Managers. The suit concerns the question of whether coverage exists under these three towers of insurance for loss in the way of defense costs incurred in an ongoing criminal action against a number of former officers of Endion's predecessors. National Union, my client, issued a series of primary D&O policies to Endion. The policy at issue in this litigation and on this appeal was in effect from September 13, 2005 to September 13, 2006. National Union filed in the trial court a motion for summary judgment based upon the application of its prior acts exclusion with regard to the criminal action. This appeal is from the trial court's denial of National Union's motion for summary judgment and the trial court's granting of Health's motion for partial summary judgment to require National Union to advance defense costs.
Mr. Bistany, let me just ask you two questions to clarify, I guess to sweep away some of the underbrush. If we were to put aside for a moment all the exclusions, would there be coverage for a claim of the kind that was made here by Endion?
The counts in the indictment, the allegations in the indictment, fall within the insuring agreement, for the most part, of the National Union policy. So, yes, originally it would fall within the insuring agreement.
All right. I mean, so there was at least underlying coverage subject to the exclusions.
Subject to the exclusions that we made the evaluation right. and it fit within the insuring agreement.
Second question. We have basically two cases here. One focuses on the prior acts exclusion. The other focuses on the prior notice exclusion. If hypothetically this court were to affirm the ruling of the Superior Court regarding prior notice, would that or would that not moot this case that involving the prior acts exclusion?
Yes and no. It would moot it as to all of the excess carriers who joined in that motion. National Union did not join in the motion at that time. National Union instead filed a motion on the prior acts exclusion, so it would not moot. It would not moot the motion on the prior acts exclusion as to National Union.
Well, as you know, the briefs cite your failure to file the motion as support for the interpretation put on the other side. Is it your position that, in response to Justice Jacobs' question, that you haven't conceded anything and that you would have the ability to now make a similar motion?
Yes. It's our position we do have the ability. We did not file at the time because, quite frankly, we did not want to drag in the underwriting history, which eventually got dragged in any event, which we thought would not be relevant if we were not involved. But we still believe that this, that particularly given Judge Cooch's ruling, that his ruling would apply equally to National Union. The history of this case is, and the underlying case, is that what we refer to as Old Medical Managers, a company that was formed in 1996 and publicly traded, had its own tower of insurance. Subsequently, in July of 1999, it was purchased by Synetic and merged into Synetic, and at that time it purchased runoff coverage for its tower of insurance and was, for future actions, covered by Synetic's tower of insurance. In September, I believe, of 2000, Synetic was then purchased by the current plaintiffs, which at the time were Healthion, WebMD, and it's gone through a few name changes to MDON and then to Health. That company had its own tower of insurance. So there basically are three towers of insurance in the underlying case. The first two towers, the Old Medical Managers Tower and the Synetic Tower, are, in our understanding now, exhausted by the more than $100 million that have been incurred in the defense of the underlying action. What we are looking at here is the third tower. And the third tower, which National Union is the primary carrier on, contains that every carrier in that tower has a policy with a prior acts exclusion. And this appeal really focuses on two issues. One, and the most important, is that the trial court erred when it failed to enforce the clear and unambiguous provisions of the prior act exclusion, which apply here even when read in conjunction with the remaining portions of the policy. And the second issue is, if the court does not agree with that, then even if the trial court were correct in its conclusion that somehow these other non-related provisions, when read with the prior acts provision, made it ambiguous, that the trial court did not have sufficient information and used the wrong standard in resolving any ambiguity. In effect, it should have allowed us to go back, do discovery, and look at all of the facts to determine the intent of the parties and what the reasonable expectations, given the underwriting history, would have been for Health in WebMD in looking at this coverage. I'm going to start with
the part. Your view is the trial judge should have denied summary judgment and let it go forward for further discovery?
No. Our view is that the policy is clear and unambiguous when looking at the prior act exclusion or when looking at the entire policy in read as a whole.
No, I understood that's your first position, but in the event we were to agree that it was ambiguous on the prior act exclusion, what happens to the
other provision? It's our position that there was no evidence of an intent to cover that was presented by Health in the trial court. That instead the trial judge inferred intent, looked at in hindsight, saw a claim that came in and that was not covered, decided that it should have been covered, and in hindsight inferred that intent when there was no evidence during the underwriting process that it was to be covered. Our position would be that there is no evidence of intent to cover this, but if there was a question, that there should have been discovery allowed to fully develop that.
I think what's confusing here is the terminology that you're using, intent to cover. I mean, you've already answered, my first question, which is whether this policy provides coverage, and the answer is yes, it does, subject only to the exclusion. So if we're going to be very precise, aren't we really talking about not whether there was an intent to cover, and we're talking in connection with this exclusion number 13, if that's the, I don't mean exclusion number 13, but the prior acts exclusion, whether the intent here was that the exclusion would not apply because of the endorsement number 13.
Well, I believe the trial court actually found or held that the policy was ambiguous because
I understand prior that. Yeah. But I mean the issue.
Yes, the intent was, I think the trial court determined that the intent was that by the amend retention endorsement, the parties intended to cover this, therefore they could not exclude it.
They intended for the endorsement exclusion to trump the exclusion. Is that what you're saying?
That's what we believe the trial court ruled.
Okay.
And it is our position that if this court believes that there is any ambiguity between those two provisions, that it should be sent back to the trial court for discovery on the underwriting process, because there was no evidence produced, there was no affidavits, there were no depositions. In fact, we were not permitted to do discovery.
Why is the court in error? Why was the court in error in determining that there's ambiguity?
Because all three provisions that the court looked at are consistent and clear. The prior acts, Your Honor asked the right question, was this covered but for the exclusions? And that's how this court, the lower court, should have looked at this. When you look at this claim, the first thing you do is decide whether it falls within the insuring agreement. It does. Then you look at the definitions and the exclusions. And this is how the policy is written. If you go through the policy, this is the order that they appear in. Then you go through the definitions and the exclusions. You come up with the prior acts exclusion, which really no one can seriously contest should not apply. It does apply. It's clear that it applies. The indictment is clear.
In your client's policy, is there any reference at all to the indictment or the Singer litigation?
No. The name Singer does not appear in the policy. The amend retention endorsement was written in 2004.
Right.
It was written subject to the 10Q that was from June of 2004. If you read that 10Q description of the investigation, it was a very vague description of what was going on in South Carolina. There was no Singer. The Singer action didn't come about until December of 2005, not only after the amendment was originally written in 2004, but after the policy was renewed with identical language in 2005.
But what was the purpose of the reference to the ongoing investigation?
The purpose of the reference was that in 2003, before that renewal, Health advised National Union that there was an investigation. Since obviously an investigation
was that a notice of circumstance?
There were negotiations that they would not give notice of circumstance under the 2002 policy.
I mean, was that a legally significant act under the policy?
They could have chosen to give notice of circumstances, which was not a claim, but it would have then brought all future claims into the 2002 policy.
Right.
I know your time's getting short, but just let me ask you. If by incorporating those acts that, you know, were ongoing in the policy, is that why the trial court concluded there was an ambiguity? Because there was notice that there might be something on the horizon, and we want to make sure if it materializes, we're covered.
No. What it was to set a retention.
Now, I know what you think it did. I'm trying
what
to.
What the court was thinking?
Is that why the court
concluded? The best I can surmise is that the judge felt that because they knew that there was a potential for something on the horizon, that that must have been intended to be covered. Our position, and we think the policy is clear, is that no, there was an intention to have a higher retention before any covered claim would be paid under the policy. That's all the retention does, is it dictates when a covered claim. You don't get to the retention until you get a covered claim, and to get a covered claim, you've got to go through the insuring agreement and all of the exclusions. And the court didn't do that. It jumped to the retention and said the retention dictates what's covered, when in fact the policy is written and clearly written the opposite direction. The coverage and the exclusions dictate when you get to the retention. One other point that I want to make is that there's a lot been that has been made by the trial court about the specific litigation exclusion. If you look at that exclusion, it is clearly not applicable here. First of all, it's intended to exclude any potential claim, and that was never any party's intent. If there's a covered claim for a medical manager out of that investigation, National Union would cover it. The second is, if you read that exclusion, it clearly applies to claims that were known before the policy or litigation that started before the continuity date. It has nothing to do with this situation, and it clearly, on its face, does not impact the prior acts exclusion. I will, if the court has no more questions for me at this time, I will reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. This case concerns a single policy sold to MDON. It's the 2005 policy only. And the question is whether insurance companies, which specifically modified their insurance policy, not only to contemplate a particular type of risk or claim, but to contemplate a particular claim, should be able instead to force through what we believe is a strained construction of boilerplate exclusions, to take that claim and exclude it with the boilerplate standard form exclusions when the specifically drafted endorsement 13 contemplates coverage for the medical manager claim.
I'm not sure what the term contemplates means analytically. It's conceded by the other side, at least if I read their brief correctly, that if Indian's claim related to or involved acts that occurred after the magic date in 1999, then it would be covered and the exclusion wouldn't apply. The problem here is that the underlying conduct occurred beginning in 1997. So there is at least one literal plain meaning construction of the prior acts exclusion under which there would be coverage. Unfortunately, it didn't apply to the particular claim that was asserted by your client. That being the case, doesn't there have to be something in endorsement number 13 that would say in words or substance, notwithstanding the prior acts exclusion, it just doesn't apply, you know, in connection with the Singer type claim?
Yes, Your Honor, endorsement 13 actually does have language to that effect in it, and it's unusual language. The prior acts exclusion happens to be in endorsement 3. Endorsement 13 says, quote, notwithstanding any other provision of this policy, including any endorsement attached hereto, whether the endorsement precedes or follows this endorsement in time or sequence. That's unusual language, Your Honor, and this is the same endorsement which defines a new class of covered securities claim, and it's called a medical manager claim. Now, I suppose you might say, well, the endorsement itself doesn't actually reference the dates of the Singer matter. However, Helt's public disclosures always have. From when the subpoenas were first served in 2003 to when the indictments came out in 2005, and at every period in between, Helt's public disclosures always disclosed the contents of the Singer matter and what the operative dates were. And our public filings that I have in my hand, the Form 10-K, which is in the record in our appendix at B50 through 56, and in this 10-K, there is a full description of the Singer matter, including the dates alleged.
So, answer two questions for me.
First, yes, Your Honor.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that the word retention is a term of art. Can you tell me what it means in the context of endorsement 13 or the amend retention? And secondly, tell me whether or not this endorsement really was intended to expand coverage or just to address the concept of how the retention would be structured.
I think the answer is both. Simply because it actually creates a new class of covered securities claim. And, Your Honor, it is an unusual endorsement. It's got unusual lead-in language. To answer your first question, with regard to what the endorsement's intended to do, it's simply a deductible which the parties bargained for. And what did the parties do? The parties determined that there was a risk out there, the Singer risk. And what did they do? They determined National Union both increased its premium and it increased its deductible, and they bargained that the deductible for this matter would be $10 million, not $5 million. So they put themselves in a better position with regard to this particular claim. At the same time, they knew what was in our public disclosures. And our public disclosures said the investigation involved matters stretching back to 1997. Now, assume that you didn't want to go there. You didn't want to rely on endorsement 13. What's another way that, frankly, we believe you can get around the prior acts exclusion without relying on endorsement 13? The fact is that this was a multi-party, multi-year conspiracy indictment. And as a matter of fact, six of the 10 people who were indicted have had the claims dismissed. Well, one has a deferred prosecution agreement, which expires in July. But six of them, their defense was actually effective. So the large number of defense costs that you heard for six of those parties were effective in defending them. But, Your Honors, the fact remains that they knew from our public filings exactly what was contained in the Singer matter. And back to the point about...
Well, let me make sure you understand why I asked the question I asked. What I'm trying to sort through is whether that endorsement, the amend retention, was a concession by naming Singer or any other related conspiratorial claims over a long period of time, that regardless of when the act occurred, it would be a covered act and it wouldn't be excluded by endorsement 3. Or was it simply a provision to say, if indeed it turns out that it will be covered, here's the way the retention will work?
Well, Your Honor,
is it indeed a concession that we're expanding or narrowing the prior act exclusion, or is it simply to address how retention would work if it is not an excluded prior act?
I'd like to be able to answer that yes or no. I think the answer is both. Because at the time negotiations
were going... Both seems to be the common answer to every question I ask.
Well, maybe you get that a lot, Your Honor. But seriously, Your Honor, with regard to endorsement 13, it was added at a time when everyone knew what the proposed facts were regarding the Singer matter, and everybody knew that those facts stretched back to 1997. Now, it just so happens that when the indictments came out, the indictments matched what everyone knew when endorsement 13 was added.
At the same time, I think that's one of the points I'm trying to understand a little better. Did everyone know that the government might allege that the acts went that far back, or did everyone know that the acts indeed did or did not go that far back?
I think everyone knew the government might allege that. I mean, in fact, to this date, the government hasn't proven anything. The trial's going on in South Carolina right now, Your Honor. I understand it's going out to the jury shortly. but the government, everyone knew what the government might allege. It just so happens that what the government ended up alleging in the indictment corresponds with what everyone knew when endorsement 13 was added. So that's not to say, Your Honor, that other exclusions might not apply. For example, there are exclusions, and we've dealt with this in the advancement motion regarding defense costs. If everyone were convicted, there are provisions of the policy, as the trial court judge, Judge Cooch, recognized, that might permit the defendants in certain circumstances to claw back certain of the defense costs which they advanced. At the time endorsement 13 was entered, no one knew whether anyone was going to be indicted or anyone was going to be convicted. But,
Mr. Passanti, I'm having trouble understanding where that's going. Let's back up for a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think everyone understands that one of your the bases that you're arguing for affirmance is endorsement 13 and the proposition that endorsement 13 renders ambiguous the prior acts exclusion, that is, when the two are read together. Correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
But then you went on and said that even if we put endorsement 13 to one side, there's a separate basis for affirmance.
Yes, Your Honor.
And after that, you made a series of factual statements, but no legal argument.
No, and Your Honor, with regard to that point, the nature of the underlying conspiracy count here is that there are multiple parties over multiple individual parties who are defendants. The nature of the conspiracy count is the illicit agreement. And that's one way of looking at the wrongful act. And here what the defendants would have you do, and as they tried to do in the underlying allocation motion early on in the case, they'll try to create an equality between the wrongful acts in the policy and the overt acts alleged in the indictment. And the simple fact is that there isn't, and with multiple parties, each of whom are entitled to...
Okay, so I think what you're saying is that there is a way to conclude that the claim by your client did not involve acts that would not be excluded because they post-dated 1999. Is that
correct,
right?
As to each individual, they have to show that all the claims for all the individuals post-date their prior acts date, even if you don't look at trying to harmonize the actual language of the policy.
And that argument is not one that was addressed by the trial court. There was no ruling.
Correct. That argument appeared in our papers, Your Honor, and it really has to do with the nature of the underlying conspiracy account and when, in fact, that wrongful act actually takes place for insurance purposes.
I just want to make it clear, or have you make it clear, that that's not an argument. It was addressed below, and therefore we would be on new ground, so to speak, if we were to go there.
That's correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, with regard to the specific event or litigation exclusion, which is exclusion 6 to the policy, and the simple question is, what's the better way? If National Union had really intended to exclude this claim, what could they have done? What should they have done? And when you look at endorsement 6 to the policy, Your Honor, endorsement 6 lists 4 claims. And I'll point one out because it's of particular interest regarding the contrast between it and what happened with the medical manager claim. Endorsement 6, which appears in the record at A0128, mentions something called the Porex mammary plant litigation. That's excluded from the policy that we're talking about. The same 10K that I mentioned earlier, which appears at B50 through 56, right after it mentions the medical manager disclosure, mentions the Porex litigation. Now, we disclose the Porex litigation. National Union knows about it. They exclude it from the policy. We disclose the medical manager Singer issue, and what happens? There's no addition to the excluded event endorsement, and as a matter of fact, we add an endorsement defining a new class of claim, which in our view clearly shows the intent of the parties And the only way you can harmonize that intent is to say that endorsement 13 conflicts with National Union's argument regarding the prior acts exclusion to such an extent that it has to overcome it, Your Honor.
And the reason you claim it overrides, that is, endorsement 13 overrides the prior act exclusion, is because of the language to the effect, notwithstanding any other endorsement in this policy, whether it proceeds or follows?
By its very terms, yes, Your Honor. That, and it was, and endorsement.
Which means that the endorsement 13, that language would override all the other endorsements, not just the prior acts exclusion.
Correct.
Yes, every exclusion.
Yes, by its very terms, it does so, Your Honor. Furthermore, even if we weren't going to go there with those terms of the exclusion, the general rule of construction that when you have a general term in a policy or a contract and a specific term, and here we have a specific term relating to Singer and the medical manager issue, that the specific term, that is endorsement 13, will control over the more general term.
Now, earlier you were saying there was an increase in the premium. Does the record reflect the direct correlation between the addition of endorsement number 13 and the increased premium?
It does not, Your Honor, because of the timing. What happened was in 03, a different way to answer that question, the simple answer is no, Your Honor. However, back in 2003, when this investigation first came to light, there were actually offers for insurance on the table. And those offers for insurance, when Health disclosed the beginning of the Singer matter, were withdrawn. Deductibles were raised, and rates were increased. That is in the record. But later, when the endorsement was actually added in 0405, there isn't actually something that says the addition of that endorsement caused an increase in premium, Your Honor.
So you stated differently, the history in the record supports the fact that there is a correlation.
Correct.
Between that risk and the increase in the premium.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, just to put this in perspective, back in 2003 and 4, this was just another claim against Health, granted a significant one. No one knew what the size of ultimate defense costs would be, or that today you would hear the sort of numbers that we're talking about with regard to defense costs. And I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Excuse me, if I may ask the clerk a question. I believe the time on the clock is incorrect. Now it is. I'm sorry. Now it went back from 13 to.
Yeah, it's not the clerk that runs the clock.
Oh.
That's why it was incorrect. I run the clock.
I'm sorry.
It's almost guaranteed to be incorrect when I'm running it. But I think you're correct.
My apologies.
I think it's right now.
Yes, it is. Let me quickly go through some of the points that Mr. Passanati raised. The language in the retention endorsement, which is an amend retention endorsement, and was not added immediately after knowledge of the potential of the investigation was known, but was added actually the next year when Health wanted to reduce its retention across the board, and this was worked out so that the retention was reduced from $10 million across the board to $5 million across the board, with $10 million for any claim that arose out of this. If you look at the initial language in that, it makes perfect sense when you realize that there is already another retention endorsement on the policy. If the retention endorsement 13 did not start with that language, it would be unclear in the policy which retention endorsement takes precedence, because there is an earlier retention endorsement, number 4, which makes changes to the certain of the liability language in the endorsement, but also includes the $5 million across the board language. So in order to have endorsement 13 take precedence over that, the introductory language was included so that it is clear that that endorsement takes precedence over any other retention provision in the policy. At the end of that endorsement, it is also clear, and the language is specific, that all other endorsements, exclusions, conditions of the policy apply. So that endorsement does not negate the prior acts exclusion. One other point that Mr. Passananti made was that somehow that if we looked at the individuals, we wouldn't have, even if you ignore the alleged ambiguity, we wouldn't have a problem with the prior acts exclusion. But as we pointed out in our briefs, both in the trial court and here, you can go through the indictment, you can go through the bill of particulars, and every individual had wrongful acts qualified under the policy, not overt acts, but wrong acts that were wrongful acts that predated the cutoff date, that predated February 10th, 1999. Every one of the individuals was alleged to have committed a wrongful act before that date, and each of the four types of fraud were alleged to have begun before that date. As far as the premium goes, in fact, there is no evidence as to what was going on in the process of the premium, but it is of interest, and it is in the record, that the premium actually decreased from 2003, when there was a $10 million across-the-board premium, to 2004, when there was the endorsement was originally added to amend the retention, and then it was decreased again in 2005. There may be a myriad of reasons why that happened. It's impossible to say without, again, going through, if you want to use the intent of the parties, you have to develop the record. There is no record on that. So if you look at the record that's here, there's no evidence that the premium was increased in that manner. One other thing is that Mr. Passananti keeps talking about everybody contemplated this claim. Nobody contemplated any claim. Everybody contemplated a potential for some or many claims. If you look at the definition and what was described in the 10Q, it is very vague and very open because nobody knew what was going to come out of this investigation. Surprisingly, not a single individual securities action came out of this investigation, which is what many people would have contemplated. These were publicly traded corporations. If they were playing fast and loose with the stock prices by rigging the balance sheets, what would you have expected? Individual securities actions. There are a number of these alleged misdeeds which occurred completely after the cutoff date, which if shareholders had brought individual actions, they would not have been precluded by the prior acts date. Yet if we had included this investigation in the specific litigation, everything that could have potentially come out of it would have been excluded. That was not the intent. It was the intent to, and it's clear from the policy, that this was simply to treat this claim as any other. Any claim that came in here would have to be looked at through the terms of the policy as you would normally look at a claim. And that all that was impacted was the retention, which was higher. Thank you very much for, I think my time is up.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Barry Basis, and I represent Fireman's Fund in this. Fireman's Fund is an excess insurer on the Endion 2005-06 policy. We adopted Mr. Bistany's argument, but we made a separate argument, which was granted by our summary judgment motion was granted by Judge Cooch, and that was on the prior notice provision. And the exclusion is in the primary policy, the National Union policy, that the insurer is not liable for any claims made against an insured alleging arising out of, based on, or attributable to the facts alleged or to the same or related wrongful acts alleged or contained in any claim of which has been reported or in any circumstances of which notice has been given under any policy of which this policy is replacement, a renewal or replacement, or which it may succeed in time. And it's that succeed in time language that the judge applied here. Now, Judge Cooch wrote a careful opinion that applied the policy language to the facts of this case. And the facts are rather striking and bear little relation to the version that you find in the plaintiff's statement of facts, because all over their statements, they repeatedly state that this case involves notices by unrelated companies, and what is one company to do when a notice comes in from an unrelated company over which it has no control? Here, the policies, well, they were originally purchased by different companies. By the time of the relevant facts in this case of when notices were given, the parent company, MDON Health, keeps changing its name, had control and power of attorney and the right to proceeds of all the policies. So while it talks about being at the mercy of these other companies out there, they were the ones who had complete control. And in fact, one example is MDON Practices Company Corporation, which was formerly the Medical Manager Corporation, and gave the first notice. That company was completely sold off in 2006, and yet MDON's health's lawyers are still here. The name is still in the caption, even though if you rule in favor of the plaintiffs, not one cent will go to Health Services Corporation because it goes to the company. All the proceeds have been going to the company, and they're the ones who are paying the bills in this case. And the facts are highlighted. They didn't even, maybe it didn't occur to them, but they didn't even try to cover their tracks. Here they retained Sherman and Sterling, one of the top law firms in the country and the world, with offices in Paris and Abu Dhabi, to give notices. They got a top insurance lawyer, Joanna Shally, and she gave notices to all three towers. Now, the first notice was a notice of circumstance. She sent out on July 21st, 2005. Now, they had known for several years about this investigation and had a lot of information, some of which was in their regulatory filings that everyone saw. But that policy was about to expire on July 23rd. So she gave a notice of circumstances, and we gave you as part of the record in this case the notice of circumstances. And the policy set out exactly how you give a notice or a notice of circumstances. And this is not an occurrence policy where you just say, oh, the house burned down or there was a fire on October 23rd. You have to show why you expect details as to why you expect that claim to be made, because in a claims-made policy, you're locking in that date as a claims-made date so that if a claim or here an indictment comes down a year or 2 years later, then the insured can come back to the insurer and say, look, even though the policy expired, you have to cover this claim.
Mr. Bassus, I would find it easier to follow your argument if you would just summarize in a sentence or so what Fireman's Fund's legal position is.
Precisely. Okay, its legal position is that MDON had control over the policies. It hired the same lawyer to give notice to the three towers. It had a tower for MDON in effect on July 23rd. That policy was good until September 13th. It should have given or could have given notice to it had a $75 million MDON tower. And while they talk about not it being unfair to MDON, all they had to do was give notice during that two-month period, and they had a top law firm. They could have given notice, and they wouldn't have jeopardized anything. What they did instead is, in September, they negotiated with various insurers, and what they wanted to do and what they did is take out a higher insurance tower with an additional $15 million of Side A coverage. And the reason you have Side A coverage is to cover the executives, the directors, for non-indemnifiable losses.
Their failure to give notice results in what consequence to their claim against your client?
It's not their failure to give notice just loses their right to coverage under the 2004 to 5 coverage. The my client's complaint is that they gave notice to medical manager on July 21st, and that's the claims made date. They had the same lawyer. They had the right to the proceeds under the policies. They should have given notice to, if they wanted to trigger, there's nobody says they have to get that coverage, but they had a right to trigger coverage under the MDON policy in 2004-05. They still would have had to deal with the prior acts issue, but they wouldn't have had a prior notice problem. And so that was their mistake. If they want, they had $75 million that was available to them. Now, I don't want to go over the same territory that you've recently gone over, but the amend retention endorsement, I counted 27 times in the two briefs filed with respect to my client that that's referred to as a Singer coverage endorsement. And as you know by now, Singer is not mentioned. It's not a coverage endorsement. It says all exclusions remain intact. And plaintiff's brief against us says, but the declarations page was changed to cover the Singer coverage. The declarations page, item four was replaced. Item four is retentions, and it sets forth retentions. The new section is, again, the new retentions, and it sets forth the retentions, which are employment practices, security claims without a medical manager, and security claims with a medical manager.
Mr. Passan, is Fireman's Fund asking us to affirm or reverse?
Oh, we're asking you to affirm.
You're asking us to affirm because you're contending that the Superior Court properly applied the prior notice exclusion.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why or in what way did it properly apply it? I'm just asking you to make your argument in terms of the policy language because I'm having a very difficult time following it.
Oh, the policy language, it talks about succeeds in time. The medical manager tower under which notice was given expired on September 23rd, 2005. Notice was given under an MDON policy which incepted on September 13th, 2005. And so there was a two-month gap between the expiration of one and the inception of the other. Plaintiff now makes a new argument.
So you're saying that under the literal language of the prior notice exclusion, it applies?
Yes. And plaintiff makes an argument now, and please excuse my Latin, justum generis, and that doctrine, in fact, was never argued before Judge Cooch, and so I don't think it should be considered here, but I think their argument is wrong because their argument is that succeeds in time and that provision is a broader term than the prior ones and therefore refers back to the earlier ones, and it's just an extension of the language. It's as if it's the example they give is dogs, cats, and other animals, and other animals refers to household pets under that circumstance, but this is more like dogs, cats, and birds. It just extends it to a different category. And here, we're applying it to a situation in which the same company had control and ownership of all the policies. So
let me see if I understand what you're saying. Your opponent thought they were purchasing coverage. It turned out that you were able to invoke the exclusion for prior notice. And they said, well, that's not fair. We didn't know about it, or it's not us. And your response is, well, you had control, and the knowledge is imputed to you. So even though you might have thought you were purchasing coverage, you agreed to a policy with a exclusion for prior notice, and we think it applies to you because you had effective control.
Yes, I remember, as Judge Cooch pointed out several places in his opinion, the insurers here were not told by MDON or Health that it had given that prior notice
to the other tower.
That.
But that's why I want to come back cutting through all of the paperwork just to a clear statement of what I think you're arguing, and that is it may be true they thought they were buying coverage. The fact of the matter is, as part of the coverage that they bought a policy that had a prior notice provision. And we're invoking the prior notice provision under the facts of this case, and Judge Cooch properly ruled that we could do that.
Yes, yes, that's correct. And when you say they had knowledge of the prior notice exclusion, they had a top law firm advising them on giving notice. It wasn't just some risk manager in their company who might have not understood the import of what they were doing. And these are claims-made policies in which...
But to that extent, that they knew that the notice was given on the 21st of July and the policy was expiring on the 23rd, your response would be when they were negotiating for what they thought was coverage, realizing that prior notice had already been given, they should have carved that out.
Well, they should have told the insurers that they had given the prior notice and said and bargained. Remember, it's an insurance policy.
No,
they could have bargained for
it. Maybe I'm not saying it very artfully, but assuming there was full disclosure of everyone when the coverage was purchased, your position is if we have a prior notice provision and you think it doesn't apply to you and you've already given prior notice, that should have been on the table so that we all knew what we were covering.
Well, or go back further. If they were in doubt, they had that two-month period during which they were buying their new insurance. They could have bargained and said, look, we can give you a notice of circumstance under the MDON 2004-5 policy, or we could wait till a claim comes in under the next policy, and where do you want it, or how much will it cost if we do it one way or the other? But what they did is they let the old policy where they had $75 million expire and then didn't tell the insurers. And so they're arguing waiver and estoppel now, but as Judge Cooch found, the insurers didn't have knowledge of the critical fact with respect to prior notice. They had the knowledge, not us.
Thank you, Mr. Mays.
Thank you very much.
My client asked that the court affirm the ruling of the court below, Judge Cooch. My client is a third excess carrier, and our position, we're not going to repeat the arguments of any of the other carriers, but essentially our position is that if the court finds that there's any ambiguity in the prior notice provision of the primary policy, that our carrier has its own prior notice language, which in essence is broader than the primary prior notice language. The lower court did not have to reach that because the lower court found that the primary policy was not ambiguous. But if this court believes that that language is ambiguous, we would ask that you look at the language of our excess policy prior notice provision, which would supersede the language in the primary policy. Unless the court has any additional questions for me, we don't have anything further to add to the argument.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Goodstein. I represent Old Republic. We agree that Judge Cooch's opinion on the prior acts should be affirmed for the reasons articulated by Judge Cooch. Old Republic is the next to the last excess carrier in the MDON Tower. Access sits above it. I rise today because we, too, have our own prior notice exclusion, which was argued below, but Judge Cooch did not reach the issue in his opinion. And I address it today because HLTH and MDON made reference to it in their briefing before this court. Now, Old Republic and Axis are the only two carriers that have the benefit of the Old Republic exclusion. The Old Republic prior acts exclusion was added by endorsement. It's not hidden in the policy. It was separately negotiated and appears as a standalone endorsement. And it reads very differently than the prior endorsement, the prior notice acts endorsement that Judge Cooch has already found to apply. This endorsement simply says that if notice was given to a policy that incepted before the Old Republic policy, then there is no coverage under the Old Republic and thus the next layer access, the access policy. Based on the clear and literal words of the negotiated endorsement, that clearly and plainly happened. Notice was given to old MMC almost 5 years before the Old Republic policy incepted on September 13th, 2005. Those facts are not in dispute, and applying the undisputed facts.
You're talking about the July 21st notice?
Correct. And if you apply, and there was also a notice to the Synetic Tower on December 22nd, 05. The Synetic Tower also incepted prior to the Old Republic policy. So if you apply the undisputed facts of this case to the literal language and unambiguous language of the endorsement that they separately agreed to, we win. Right? They have several responses, but they never actually respond to the specific language of this policy. Instead, the HLTH and MDON pretend to create an ambiguity by relying on the succeed in time language that is found in the primary policy. Now, while we disagree with their analysis, and we believe that Judge Cooch analyzed that language correctly in his opinion below, the succeed in time language doesn't appear in this endorsement anywhere. Likewise, the argument of HLTH and MDON that these various policies, these three towers, provided concurrent coverage is irrelevant.
But let me make sure I understand the purpose of your argument. Judge Cooch didn't agree that, didn't address this. You're submitting it as an alternative basis for affirming what he decided. Is that correct?
You're exactly right, Your Honor. And the only reason that I'm rising today is because in the opening brief of HLTH and MDON, they put it at issue before this court. So this court need not reach this issue. If it were to affirm on the grounds that Judge Cooch found on the prior acts in the exclusion in the National Union policy, then you don't reach this issue. All I'm suggesting is, while we agree with that, if for some reason this court were to determine otherwise, at least as to Old Republic and Axis, the top two layers, there is an independent basis for us to prevail that factually cannot be rebutted. The ambiguities that they try to manufacture to get around it don't apply because the language simply is not in this endorsement that they say creates the ambiguity. So they again try to rely on, in an apparent attempt to defeat this language, the notion that this was three different entities and policies issued to three different companies. But the fact remains is that all of the obligations to indemnify the directors and officers are on trial flowed to HLTH and MDON, and it was HLTH and MDON who received the benefit of in excess of $100 million under those insurance programs. They can't have it both ways. They can't say to this court, I believe, we want the benefit of those that in excess of $100 million, but we're not going to live with the policy terms that may operate to preclude coverage. Finally, they say that we effectively had notice of this for all of the reasons that have already been stated by Mr. Passananti. And I would just like to point out, and we're probably going to hear about it in rebuttal, that in negotiating these policies, HLTH clearly understood that they had to give notice, that we knew that a claim might arise isn't enough. And on page 9 of their brief, they note correspondence from the broker, where the broker said, in speaking to National Union, not my clients, that they were seeking confirmation that by foregoing notice to the expiring policy, we are not jeopardizing our ability to notice the later policies. They understood they had to provide that notice.
We're going to have to end at this point. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, very briefly on the prior notice point, we believe, Health believes that the trial court erred in finding that the prior notice exclusion unambiguously excludes all coverage. On both of these arguments, the insurance companies bear the burden of proving their exclusion. The insurance companies bear the burden of proving that all coverage for defense costs here is unambiguously excluded by the policy language. And the policy language here is important, and I'll focus on the primary level language. And what should happen here, Your Honors, is let's find out what the parties intended. Well, what does this primary prior notice exclusion do? It's designed to prevent multiple towers of insurance sold to one risk, meaning MDON's insurance. There's only one tower of MDON insurance at issue. And you just heard Mr. Goodstein talk about an email back in 2004 regarding whether or not an earlier tower of MDON insurance would be triggered. It was not. The 2005 policy is the only MDON tower of insurance that's been triggered. That's what these prior notice exclusions are for. What did MDON do? It protected its rights under the old MMC tower of insurance. Is it fair to say that an old MMC tower of insurance is a policy of which this policy, the MDON policy, is a renewal or replacement or which it may succeed in time? Fairly put, even without saying that they've got the burden of proving this unambiguously excludes everything, but fairly put, what does that mean? That means an MDON policy. Why is it worded that way? It's worded that way in case an enterprising coverage lawyer might come up and say, well, you gave notice under your 2004 MDON policy, but it's not a renewal or a replacement, but it succeeds in time. That's what this, it's to prevent multiple MDON policies from applying. So when you focus on the policy language itself, it's clear that the old MMC language shouldn't trigger the prior notice clause. In sum, Your Honor, with regard to Mr. Basis's point that somehow Fireman's Fund was misled, again, I'll point you to the 10K that I referenced earlier and compare that to the July 21st, 2005 letter that's in the record at A-259. The information that's in Ms. Shally's notice of circumstance letter appears in our 10K. So there was nothing that was kept from our insurers. They had it in our public filings. Then the question becomes, what's the effect of that notice of circumstance? What did we do? We protected $20 million in insurance coverage, which had we not given that notice of circumstance, at least by July 23rd, but on July 21st, 05, Fireman's Fund and these defendants would be exposed $20 million sooner. So the net effect of our protecting that $20 million in old MMC coverage was to put something between these defendants and having to pay the first dollar of defense costs. So that actually protected them, and the economic impact of our giving that notice of circumstance, which served to anchor the claim, we could have anchored this claim in the 03 or the 04 policy. Everyone understood it wasn't excluded going forward. There was no claim against us until December of 05. Within a week of that claim actually being made, notice went out. So the purpose of that notice of circumstances in the case of the old MMC policy was to protect insurance, which actually inures to the benefit of these defendants. And if you have no further questions, Your Honor, I see my time's up.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.